Hello and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is the podcast of free minds, free markets, and free takes. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my illustrious colleagues, Catherine Mengu Ward and Matt Welch, as well as very special guest, Kristen Soltis Anderson. Everybody say hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hello.
Kristen, happy Monday. Welcome to the show. So, I want to start with you and what you do. You're a Republican pollster. You're also a regular on cable news. You conduct focus groups and write guest pieces for the New York Times. And you wrote a book on millennial voters a few years ago, The Selfie Vote, which was quite prescient about younger voters and social media. So I'm sort of tempted to start by asking if there's anything you don't do. But I actually just want to know, like, what does it mean to be a Republican pollster? I assume you don't, you know, like spend your week calling 1,000 Republican voters personally and asking them what they think of Donald Trump, but you do something.
That's right. So for those who are less, you don't work in the polling world, I often get asked, why would you be a Republican pollster? Does that mean you only survey Republicans? Does that mean you specialize and study Republicans? What it really means is that for better or worse in Washington, consultants kind of have to pick a team. There are nonpartisan pollsters. You have the Gallups, you have the Pews, et cetera, of the world. But for those who want to provide data to partisan clients, you do kind of have to pick a team. You're not really going to find a pollster that's working for, progressive left organizations and conservative right-wing organizations. So we wind up, essentially what it means is, I will do polling for clients who are sort of center to center right. And then from time to time, if there's an interesting coalition to be made between right and left on something, I will often partner up with a Democratic pollster. So I have some clients in criminal justice reform or some clients in the clean energy space that, you know, they are trying to figure out how do I talk to Republicans? And I can help with that. But it doesn't mean I only survey Republicans, and it doesn't mean I only work for Republicans.
That's fascinating. I don't think I've ever heard you explain it quite like that before. And that's good, because it turns out we are going to ask you some questions about Democrats on the big show that we have coming up. We're going to talk about the New York mayoral race, what it means that they elected a socialist, I guess. We're going to check in on the big, beautiful bill and what's going on with Republicans. There is a brand new 1,000-page draft, not that anyone's actually read it. And we're going to dig into the general state of the Republican Party under Donald Trump. Well, New York City Democrats voted for a socialist. Last week, Assemblyman Zoran Mamdani won a surprise victory in the Democratic primary race for the city's mayoral race. Mamdani isn't just a socialist in the sense that he is on the left, that he wants higher taxes. He has longstanding ties to the Democratic Socialists of America, and he favors policies such as a citywide rent freeze, publicly funded childcare, and city-run grocery stores. If you want to get your zucchini from the government, he's your guy. He was also aided by the fact that his biggest nemesis was former New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo of lying about COVID nursing home deaths fame and many other things. So the big question I have is, did New York voters vote affirmatively for Mamdani and his brand of socialism, or did they vote against Cuomo and the ineffective, aging, corrupt, self-dealing, kind of creepy establishment that he represents? Kristen, I know you're a Republican pollster, but this sounds like the sort of question that a pollster can answer.
I think it's probably a bit of both. I think we have it is a tale as old as time that somebody who is an entitled, longstanding politician just assumes that they've won elections before and therefore winning elections is the default setting. And so they don't do the things required to ensure that they keep on winning. There's lots of evidence that that happened here with Cuomo, who, you know, even in the early polling may have started off with a dominant lead, but that was only because the non-Cuomo vote was being splintered a million different ways by a million people who had very low name ID. It did seem clear early on that there was a hunger for, oh, please not this guy. But I also don't want to take anything away from Mamdani. I think that populist viewpoints blended with real communications savvy and an understanding of how to reach voters in the year of our Lord 2025 is a pretty unbeatable combination these days. Not too many politicians have it, but he's clearly one of them. I've been thinking a lot over the last couple of days about the video of him going around to halal carts, talking about how, like, the cost of a plate of chicken and rice is too high, and we need to make it cheaper. I would argue that most of his policies are not necessarily going to achieve those reduced cost of living type ends, or at least not do so without enormous government subsidies and intervention. But he was focused on the right issue. He was doing so in a way that is very smart communication strategy. And so I would take his victory less as an endorsement of the far left on the part of the New York Democratic primary electorate, and more that establishment politicians should take nothing for granted, and populism that focuses on cost of living is extremely politically potent these days.
Matt, you live in New York. What is your sense of the reason why a young social media socialist, won this race? I assume it was not his former rap career as Young Cardamom.
Maybe that didn't hurt somehow. Or at least people weren't exposed enough to be repelled by it. I think it's important to point out, as I not answer your question, that...
thank you. I appreciate you just letting us know.
That there isn't an establishment in New York. I mean, Andrew Cuomo was not the establishment candidate because the establishment Democratic Party kicked him out. They drummed him out of office for his sex pests problems, as whether he's perverted or Italian or a little bit of both problems. To the extent that there's a Democratic establishment, it is Chuck Schumer, who's 5,000 years old, and there's no real love for the guy. It's Kathy Hochul, who's sort of this hapless state politician who became governor. And she has not endorsed Mamdani, appointedly. Eric Adams is an anti-establishment candidate, and he's just crazy. Last I looked, there's been a wave of anti-establishment,
Not in a good way, I assume.
Almost exclusively not in a good way, though occasionally he'll say something so crazy that it's almost funny. Like, come to New York. We got everything, like 9/11. you have to have a little bit of dark humor for that one. Their anti-establishment messaging has worked in New York, not least for which Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump did a way better in 2024 in and around New York City and among communities that were thought like impossible to do well. The House of Representatives changed hands in 2022, largely on the strength of Republicans like George Santos, who no one knew anything about. And if they knew anything about him, they'd go, holy crap. But he wasn't a Democrat because people were fed up with Democratic misgovernance in New York. AOC was an anti-establishment candidate. There was some corpse named Joe Crowley, who was very important in the leadership of the Democratic Party for 1,000 years, and no one could identify him in the police lineup. She ran against him in 2018 and was able to win. So there's an anti-establishment thirst in New York politics, and there's just sort of a hole there. There isn't anyone who inhabits that space. So yes, that's part of it. But also, Kristen's absolutely right there in that it's fun to vote for someone who seems like fun and energetic and who goes out there, does things like after Trump won the election, interviewed a bunch of Trump voters on the streets. One of the canniest and sort of most accessible things that a person can do. The Democratic electorate here in New York City is definitely super progressive. And so they're doing a little victory dance. The open question is that going to be anywhere like a large number of people in a general election, after which we have 4 months of looking up the whole, back clips of him saying, I don't know, 4 years ago, that we need to seize the means of production. There's a sizable electorate in New York City that doesn't like that stuff, doesn't like defunding the police, doesn't like all the things that he said in 2020 and 21, and doesn't necessarily want government-owned, supermarkets. So it's a mix.
Catherine, let's talk about the specific policies here. I think sort of if you want to describe him generally, Mamdani is, he's a socialist, but specifically he's somebody who wants to subsidize things, wants to regulate things, wants government programs for things, wants sort of everything to be run through the public sector. We talk about government-run grocery stores. It's a little bit of a joke idea. I think for him, it's actually not a joke idea, but it's quite representative of the way he goes about thinking about policy challenges is, what if the government just did this and controlled the prices? Presumably, they would not just be government-owned government grocery stores. They would also have price controls set by the government. It would be something like what we see in control states where, the state runs a liquor store and those prices are set by the state. And then the selection's not that great and you can't find the stuff that you want. So just sort of talk me through his policy mix and like what you think is, I assume you don't think that there's much to like about it.
So I think, what KSA said is right, which is that he's correctly identified the problems and then just like absolutely like whiffed on the solutions, right? So he's like, hey, people would like a cheap place to live. People would like to be able to take a subway that gets them where they want to go safely. People would like to have cheap food. I like those things too. I just think he's like radically, spectacularly wrong about how to achieve them. The trouble is, I think a lot of New Yorkers do agree with him, at least directionally, that the solution to all of these problems is more government action. Or at least they sort of uncritically accept that that might be an option. And so I think that's the thing. Like a couple weeks ago when we were talking about this on the pod, I said, actually, it feels like Cuomo versus Mamdani is what the Democratic electorate looks like in New York City to me. It's like vaguely socialist, sort of grumpy radicals, and then like exhausted establishment Democrats. And the vaguely socialist, grumpy radicals have the upper hand right now. But I think that that's, you know, as Matt said, like TBD how that goes in the general. I will say like some of his criminal justice stuff, I know people are going to go after him for abolish the police, but like some of his criminal justice stuff I think is pretty sensible, pretty good. I did talk to a person who shall remain unnamed who identifies as a libertarian in New York when I was there last week who voted for Mamdani because they think he is likely to be better on some of the things they care about than others. So there is such a thing as the libertarian Mamdani voter. There is at least one. I met her. Thoughts and prayers for her future.
Kristen, so much of the Mamdani's win was clearly about cost of living generally, but more specifically, it seems like a lot of it was about the price of rents, the cost of rents and owning a home. And there's a Wall Street Journal headline a week or two ago that was something like New York housing prices are so high that they just might elect a socialist, right? So do you think there is something to that, that it's that like, yeah, sure, there's the government-run grocery stores and price controls on zucchini, but like mostly this is about rent in New York, which is just insanely high.
Wasn't there somebody who ran for, I believe, governor of New York on the party was literally called The Rent is Too Damn High?
Yeah.
This is
yeah, and I believe there was actually a rap song called "The Rent Is Too titled "The Rent Is Too Damn High" within the last decade or so, mostly about New York.
So it's not completely new, but I think it's been exacerbated by things like rising interest rates. And whenever I look at data about what the key economic concerns are for different demographic groups, housing costs are an acutely big concern for younger voters. A data point that absolutely blew my mind was an analysis of all of the mail ballots that had been processed so far, of all the ballots, including the mail ballots processed through, I think, like toward the end of last week, that the biggest group of voters, just in terms of raw numbers, were young voters in this primary. As someone who's written about young voters a lot, that doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. So the fact that he was able to get people on board with turning out for him because he was talking about this thing that really is the number one issue, especially to younger voters, I think is notable. But the other thing that I think is fascinating is, you know, I would argue that he won in part by talking about the issues voters really cared about. But I think it's been fun to watch Democratic consultants really panic about like, what does this all mean about our base? And rather than viewing it as, hey, this was a guy who was just talking about the right issues, thinking it means like our base demands insanity in order to win. There was a quote from it was described as an unnamed centrist Democratic strategist in Playbook. And it said, it's extremely alarming that the only candidates who excite our voters are ones making absolutely insane promises on politically toxic positions, leaving us in a bad spot of trying to execute on bad policy and losing terribly, or failing to keep our promises and reinforcing the idea that all politics is BS. And this is, I hear this and it reminds me so much of the way centrist Republican strategists had complete contempt for the Republican base, like during the Tea Party era, like, oh my gosh, can you believe the insane people they keep voting for instead of the perfectly normal centrist establishment Republicans we keep offering them? And so it's just, it's like, it's really taking me back about a decade ago.
Yeah, I think there is a way in which it's definitely too much to say that Mamdani is the Democratic Trump. On the other hand, it does sort of seem like he is riding a similar kind of wave of dissatisfaction with the party establishment that Trump rode, and that he is confounding the party establishment in kind of the same way. But I want to ask Matt Welch about the housing question, because Matt, like I said, you live in New York. You have been paying rent in New York for some number of years now. And there's another group of kind of Democratic aligned people who have been talking about housing costs recently, but they're not considered the crazy fringe socialist radicals. They're kind of on the other side of the argument, and they are the abundance agenda people. I know they're absolutely your
favorite. I'm going to cut you.
Yeah.
I am going to cut you. You just had a socialist win, and you're talking about the abundance agenda. What is it going to take?
I'm talking about the abundance agenda because there is now this argument that that I'm seeing in Democratic circles that, in fact, both of them are right in some way. That the abundance agenda people kind of nailed it on how to get there, but that the socialists are actually better at talking about what the problem is, which is everything costs too damn much, and we as politicians have a responsibility to try and solve that problem. Do you think that there is some sort of weird intra-democratic like horseshoe here between the abundance people and the socialists?
I'm going to so militantly not answer this question. Okay. I will, which is, there's going to be a lot of overthinking. There already has been. The one class of people who is absolutely excited about Mamdani winning are political hot take slingers. They like suddenly have something to talk about for 4 months. It could be very, very exciting for all of them. The other class of people who is super excited is Donald Trump and the Republican Party. They want to run against this guy forever. It's great for them. They love calling him a communist, which I think Trump did just today. And then PolitiFact is going to say, actually, he's not a communist. And then everyone's going to hate the media. And the cycle is going to be wonderful to watch. Ironically, there is one person who ran in this mayoral race that polled or did better than a completely flatline response, which is Brad Lander, who also endorsed Mamdani and would have in a Mamdani administration, he'd be something like the deputy mayor. He would have a ton of power. He's the current comptroller. He's a former city councilman. He was my city councilman. He's awful, bog standard de Blasio style lefty, but he knows how the government works. And he also is responsible for some of the policies that have created the most new building of apartments in New York, which is very close to where I live. I walk right down the street, go to the Gowanus Canal, which is a Superfund site of toxic death and old mafia hits sort of bubbling up to the surface. And alongside it, there are thousands of units going up because they just needed to do some rezoning, which Brad Lander led that process. And there's enough affordable housing cutouts and whatever, and we'll have this community art center. But they built a bunch of housing, which is great. And I like it, and I'm happy for that. It's the only thing you'll ever hear me say nice about Brad Lander. I don't think that shows that there's anything like an abundance agenda approach towards housing in New York City. Christian Britsky wrote a great piece for us last week, pointing out accurately that everybody in New York politics is a housing socialist, that Eric Adams approved a rent freeze a few years ago. Just today, he came out with his, because of course, you have to have very important positions on the rent in New York, because New York has the most insane government impacted rental markets and housing markets you can ever imagine. So something like 1/4 of the people who live in New York City are in rent stabilized apartments. So, you know, the rent board is really important. So today, Eric Adams says, OK, I'll have 1.4% increase this year is my recommendation. It's all nuts. But Andrew Cuomo, too, wanted a rent freeze at some point. Everybody talks about this and has that kind of approach. I think the single most underrated part of this election was in the final 2 weeks before the vote. Rents increased by 15% in New York City. That's impossible to imagine, but it's true because they.
And was there a reason for
there
that?
There was. There was a policy called the FAIR Act, the Fairness, Affordability, Rent, something or other, basically outlawing broker fees on apartments because many of the crazy things that happened in New York City is that you pay for like a broker a ton of money to help find you a place, even if you don't need a broker. I moved into a place and it's like I got it because I knew a guy named Jerry, but still we had to Jerry Ears, by the way, his name is locally, but we still had to pay a broker like 2.5 months worth of rent, even though he did nothing. It's just it's infuriating. And so populists and the politicians of all stripes said, let's stop that. Let's stop the broker fees, make it illegal. And so they did. And, you know, buzzkills like libertarians point out, like, you know, landlords are going to just like if they have to eat it, they're going to pass that along and your rents are going to go up. And that's exactly what happened. They went up 15% in the first week that this went into effect on June 11th. And that's the atmosphere in which you see this handsome, young, head tilty guy who is walking around with a microphone and a suit saying everything's too expensive. And they're like, yes, it is. I just saw the rents go up by 15% without thinking through like, oh, all of our idiot leftoid housing policy has contributed to this incredibly inelastic market. And there will never be an abundance Democrat who is in charge of anything in New York City until I am safely dead.
Catherine, does this make you think at all of that great old Thomas Massie quote that we go back to all the time, where Thomas Massie was talking about the Tea Party and why voters elected him and people like him? And he was like, you know, at first I thought they were voting for me and my policies and my ideas. And then they elected Donald Trump and I realized it had nothing to do with me and my policies and my ideas. They were just voting for the craziest son of a bitch on the ballot. I slightly butchered that quote, but that's basically the idea. And he definitely said son of a bitch. Do you think that there is some like that this is now happening to New York Democrats?
I don't know. I guess I think that a lot of the people who voted for Mamdani don't see him as a crazy son of a bitch. And that actually is the thing that that is more interesting about it. Like if this was just a kind of populist, you know, scream into the night, I just don't think it would look the way it looks. It wouldn't be the demographic that it is. It wouldn't be, I mean, I could be wrong, but I think that this is more about, if there is a parallel on the right, I would say it's more about the like, fine, you think I'm a extreme version of my ideology? I'll be an extreme version of my ideology. I think that's a little more of what it feels to me like is going on. So the way that conservatives and particularly kind of MAGA conservatives said, like, fine, you think we're like radical, you know, baby starving white nationalists, like we'll do it. We're going to cut SNAP and, you know, end affirmative action. And I kind of think that might be what's happening here. Like if every Republican in America is going to call every Democrat a socialist, then they're like, fine, let's just be socialists.
Kristen, speaking of abundance people on the left, Matt Iglesias has this idea that I've been like, stroking my chin over like, what does this mean for the last couple of weeks, which is he keeps sort of mentioning in like paragraph 17 of his newsletters that there's a huge amount of voter interest. And he's talking nationally, not about New York, but he keeps talking about how there is a huge amount of voter interest in a radical systematic change, right? They hate the system, but they also don't really favor many specific policy changes. And like you say, well, certainly not big ones, right? Like, do you want to change Medicare? Do you want to change Social Security? Do you want to radically cut defense spending? Do you want to do things very differently than they have been done before? And they're like, no, we don't want to do that. We just want a totally different system that is exactly the same as the one we have now. What do you think about what's causing this gap between what voters say they want in terms of radical systematic change and what they also say they want in terms of specific policy preferences?
So I think that the difference here is that people want some level of stability in their own lives. And so to the extent that they think the status quo is not delivering on that, they are very open to radical change in search of stability. I wrote a column about a year and a half ago in the lead up to the 2024 election that sounded a little bit crazy and counterintuitive, but it was the idea that Donald Trump, who has always run as I'm a wrecking ball, I'm your retribution, I'm going to be the bull in the china shop, all of that, was actually running as I'm going to be Mr. Stability. I'm running as the person who is against the chaos that is overtaking us. And so the idea of Donald Trump running as like the candidate of stability seemed unusual, but that was a big piece of his messaging. And I think that's the tension you're talking about, is that people don't want upheaval in their own lives. They don't want chaos in their own lives. They don't want to have to learn how to navigate some new portal or system to access something they've already been accessing or to navigate their day-to-day lives. But they do think that the system as constituted now isn't necessarily delivering on the level of, I just want to live my life and be able to afford to, live well and have a family or own a home or do the things that I say I want to do. They don't feel like the system is giving them that, which means they sound more open at a 35,000 foot level to big systemic change, even if what they're really just looking for is more stability and normalcy for their own day-to-day lives.
All right. That is a good note to make some big changes on this podcast. And by big changes, I mean, let's go to an advertisement before we take our listener question. If you're tired of cable news debates and Twitter shouting matches, and you're looking for serious, good faith conversations between people who actually care about liberty, then it is time to check out the Future of Freedom podcast. Each episode dives deep into a single topic, tariffs, campus speech, DOGE, and brings together two guests who disagree about the best path forward. But here's the twist. This isn't a debate show. No interrupting, no dunking. Each guest, whether libertarian or conservative, has to make their own case, not just tear down the other side. It's compelling, it's civil, it's genuinely challenging. You will hear familiar reason voices like Nick Gillespie, Stephanie Slade, and Joe Lancaster, alongside other principled thinkers on the right and center right. Each brings sharp ideas to the table. So if you believe the future of freedom depends on more than just winning arguments, and you are ready for something deeper than the usual echo chambers, please check out the Future of Freedom podcast. Real disagreement, real ideas, real conversations. Subscribe to the Future of Freedom wherever you get your podcasts. That's Future of Freedom. All right, this week's listener question comes from Todd. It might not seem directly relevant to current events, but I think as we get into things, you will understand that it is. So Todd writes, I recently read The Deficit Myth by Stephanie Kelton. This is a somewhat older book. If nothing else, it was interesting to hear the logic behind MMT. That's modern monetary theory, which basically argues that deficits do not matter. The only thing that really does matter is inflation. What it failed to do, what this book failed to do, was touch on any of the downsides besides inflation of running government finances this way. Why should I, as a libertarian-leaning anti-partisan, hate MMT, and what dangers does it pose? Catherine, let's start with
you. I'm just going to say what you taught me about this in your feature that you wrote many years ago, which is that MMT is just supply-side economics for the left. It's a way of having your cake and eating it too. You can spend all the money and nothing bad will happen is a promise that sounds amazing to anyone who might be in a position to spend money. And it's just window dressing. It's just a sort of chalkboard full of equations that in the end justifies what the politicians were going to do anyway, which is spend a lot of money. And I think the way that this connects up, obviously, is Big Beautiful Bill and how all that's going down. And
we are going to get to that in just a moment.
But I think it is remarkable how well absorbed into the kind of baseline assumptions of a lot of these debates MMT has become. A lot of smarty smart pants people feel comfortable now saying deficits don't matter. And if you ask them for the details, they're going to wave their hands and say MMT. And everyone kind of says like, oh, yeah, OK. So congratulations to the MMTers, they kind of won.
Kristen, let me frame it for you this way. In some ways, this is just a restatement of the previous question I asked you, but voters always say that they support a balanced budget, low deficits, right? Like debt. And yet they never, ever want to cut anything big, anything that actually matters. They're always like, well, we'll cut foreign aid. And foreign aid is maybe 1% of the budget. The numbers just don't add up, even if you eliminate 100% of foreign aid right now. So can you, in your capacity as a pollster, help us understand why voters constantly say they want no debt, low deficits, and also not to do anything that would get us there?
Isn't this just a diffuse benefits concentrated costs problem at some level, that like having a balanced budget is a thing that sounds lovely and important, but the benefits of that are pretty diffuse? It's hard for somebody to say, here's how my life will be different if we have a balanced budget. But if you have somebody who they are on Medicaid, or you have somebody who avails themselves of a variety of different public services, the idea that you are going to cut that particular thing that really affects them, suddenly that is concentrated. It is not hard for them to make the leap and say, oh, this is how this hurts me. And so that's why you will always see this big gap in polling, where people like the idea in theory of having a balanced budget. It sounds nice. It sounds like the right thing to do. But they believe that there is a significant amount of things like waste, fraud, and abuse, that you can go after all of that stuff first before you have to touch any of the stuff that affects my life. Because the stuff that's affecting my life and making my life better, that's not waste, that's not fraud, that's not abuse. I think there is a sense that perhaps if the government was the right size, it would also, to where it's providing the services people believe government ought to be providing, that you can do that in a way that's not running up massive deficits. But on the question of what it would take to get there, people are kind of unwilling to really go there on the trade-offs. One question that we asked that I think is particularly interesting is, we asked people, we said, if you had to choose one of the following three things, you can only pick one, which one would you pick? And we offered a balanced budget, keeping taxes low on everyday Americans, or protecting important programs from cuts. And we left this all very vague, right? Like, what does keeping taxes low mean? What do important programs mean? But when you ask it in that way, basically nobody prefers the balanced budget. Republicans say, given those three things, they want the lower taxes. Democrats say, given those three things, balanced budget is somewhat appealing, but more appealing is protecting key programs from cuts. Like, the balanced budget doesn't have anybody who's like really advocating for it in the face of those two other things.
Hey, we're sitting right here, dude.
Yeah.
It's rude of you, honestly.
Thank you for coming on the podcast, though. Matt Welch. So what do you think of the listener question, just generally, but also what lessons can libertarians, or should libertarians, take from this sort of frustrating gap between the desire for a balanced budget, which all of us actually support doing things to get to, and the fact that the public just
magical thinking always works politically, at least until it doesn't. And I mean, the answer to the question is, like, why should I be against MMT? A load of crap, and we should be against things that are loads of crap. We should be against magical thinking, except in literature. But also, we live in a world where we're already dealing with the negative side effects of all of this stuff. Inflation was one of those negative side effects. But also, we're 8 years away from mandatory 24% haircut on Social Security payouts. Whoops. That's going to be a remarkable upheaval in American life, political life, and elsewhere. We are facing right now very close to $1 trillion debt service every year, right? We have more than 36 trillion, maybe 37 trillion now, national debt. Something like 80% of that has to be sort of rolled over in the next 4 years and refinanced. Interest rates are pretty high. That's all real super bad. It has direct, tangible, negative effects because we chose not to deal with any of this very obvious, slow-moving catastrophe right in front of our eyes, partially because a lot of people, and not just, you know, newfangled MMT people, embraced magical thinking. On the right, the magical thinking embodied by Donald Trump was like, nah, we're not going to just hands off the Social Security, Medicare. Paul Ryan is a poopy head and we're just not going to deal with that. But also on the centrist abundance agenda left, Peter Suderman, if you're going to keep name checking Matt Iglesias, let's talk about him being enthusiastic in 2009 and 2010. Like, it'd be irresponsible not to do a massive government borrowing right now because costs are so low. Let's just go for it and do it. This sort of cheeky centrist.
And to be fair, that wasn't just liberal commentators. That was also the economic advisors inside the Obama administration were saying
Paul Krugman was very much about that, talking about the bond vigilantes and just poo-pooing all of the ideas that before had more of an audience. The Larry Summers 1990s Democratic Party, which like paid attention to some of this stuff and like maybe we should pay down debt and have a smaller government. All that went by the wayside in the early Obama era. And we live in the world that they helped create. So congratulations to all of them as they, you know, scramble eventually when the bill is coming due right now. It's coming due in many different forms right now. That's why you should oppose this. And that's why you shouldn't forgive those who cheekily offered more and more of this denialism in the face of political pressure to yield to the kind of lowest common denominator politics that we have right now.
I just want to go back and establish that Matt Welsh is anti-MMT, but objectively pro-Joan Didion. Is that, would you say? Objectively pro Gabriel Garcia Marquez. You said we're allowed to have it in our writing.
Didion, I'd like really not as much in her fiction, but Gabriel Garcia and Bohumil Hrabal, as we've discussed.
That's true. Okay, we'll give it to the Czechs per usual.
The reason not to run your finances in the way that MMT people say that the government should run its finances is that they're wrong, that they're kind of full of it. It's BS. It just doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense because fundamentally their argument is deficits do not have consequences. Okay, maybe inflation sometimes, but then what's their argument for when inflation happens is Congress should deal with that by changing tax policy. That's really, really hard. It doesn't work that way. Congress has shown again and again that they can't respond in the moment to fiscal challenges. We're going to talk about that. That's happening right now, and we're going to talk about it in just a minute. And so we have lived through the consequences of not exactly MMT, not MMT. The MMTers are all like, oh, we didn't actually do MMT. It's never been tried. But the idea of it, that deficits don't matter, that overspending doesn't matter, we just lived through several years of inflation caused by overspending, caused by not worrying about deficits in the moment because it was an emergency. We saw the consequences. They're real. The MMTers are wrong. So, as a reminder, we love to answer your short, concise, pithy, and not very long questions. You should send your questions to podcasts@reason.com. Also, we get so many questions, we just can't answer all of them here, but we are going to try to answer some of them on YouTube bonus episodes, maybe as soon as this week, in which we're gonna respond to some challenges we got to last week's question about selling off public lands. We're all for it. Some of you, I know, are skeptical. We're going to talk more about that on YouTube later this week. And that is a nice segue to our next segment on the state of the GOP under Trump. Let's start with the big news from this weekend. Senate has finally released its draft of the big, beautiful bill. Nearly 1,000 pages. Tax and spending behemoth is released at midnight on Friday, has already been changed multiple times over the weekend, and it may be changed, may be changing as we are recording this podcast right now. And yet, Republicans hope to vote on this thing and get it to Trump's desk, which would also mean the House passing the version, a new version again. They want to do this by Friday. Where have we seen this before? Does anyone actually like this? Kristen, like, what does the polling tell us, first of all, about the bill generally, but also, aren't people upset about this totally insane way that we always do these giant spending packages?
So I'll start with your last question first, which is, yes, people think it is crazy, but process is not what moves voters in the way that personal impact will. So I think if you're coming up with reasons to say this bill is bad and should not be passed, the fact that it was passed through this reconciliation process and through, you were trying to rush it through before July 4th, like that's not the kind of thing that your average voter is going to care about as much as the idea of, wait a minute, Medicaid cuts in my state, is that going to hurt me? Cuts to this program that I like, is that going to hurt me? I mean, there's Democrats, I think the smarter Democrats have started to message more about the, like, what will these cuts mean to you personally, and specifically for pieces of Trump's coalition. You know, about 10 years ago, there was this real makers and takers dynamic where Republicans were like, we're the party of the makers and the Democrats are the party of the takers, the people who are on the dole. And that has changed a little bit in the era of Trump bringing in more working class voters. Who are not looking to have, you know, major government programs that they benefit from slashed. They would like to see those programs not go to people they think are undeserving, but they think of themselves as quite deserving of that hand up from their fellow taxpayer. And so that's the thing that I think is going to be more likely to create political problems for Republicans over the next, you know, however many months until we head into the midterms, is not, was this bill passed under cover of night, or was it passed along harshly partisan lines, or any, or it was a 1,000-page huge bill that tried to do too many things, but rather, are the things that it does things that are going to make people's cost of living better or worse? Is it going to make their dealings with government better or worse? Those are the things that are going to define the political outcomes here.
Catherine, is there anything to like about this bill? It's going to add trillions of dollars to the deficit, no matter what the Trump administration says. I mean, yes, maybe if you use a current policy baseline to basically say that the tax changes don't matter. But that's not how we score bills. That is never how we've scored bills. And in fact, the reason that the tax changes are there is because, of course, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 set an expiration for the tax changes in that bill for a decade out, with the understanding, explicit in some cases, that Republicans and Democrats might try to extend those tax cuts. So this was always the plan here, to keep these taxes the way they are and to raise the deficit. Is there anything to like about this bill? Is there anything good that you have to say about it?
I'm going to boldly ignore the advice of KSA and talk about the procedural aspects because I'm like that. And the answer is, a thing I like about this bill is something that Chuck Schumer is responsible for, which is it out loud. They spent all day yesterday reading it out loud. It took 16 hours. And they finished it at 3 o'clock yesterday being Sunday. Listen, it was a delay tactic. It had nothing to do with transparency. Certainly, the senators were not there listening to the bill being read. So I don't want to say that anyone has read the bill. I don't think
one person read the bill, or a group of people have read large chunks.
I assume they worked in shifts. Yeah, no. I actually still think maybe not even like the clerks worked in shifts. But at least the bill in its current form was read aloud for the public, should anyone care. That is the lowest possible standard. The bar, as they say, is on the floor. And yet here we are. At least the contents of the bill are public in some meaningful way. And as horrible as it is, we have Chuck Schumer to thank for that.
In so many ways, this bill is Trump's Moby Dick, not just his white whale in terms of he's been trying to get it passed. But you, Catherine, have told me about some college tradition where they read Moby Dick all the way through, just like for a week or something. You want to, this is why you actually like this bill, right? The reading of it.
It reminds me fondly of a bunch of idiots in college sitting in a common room and reading Moby Dick aloud once a year as a fun tradition. There is a lot of drinking involved, both in the book Moby Dick and also in the reading aloud of Moby Dick in college. I don't know how much drinking has been involved with the Big Beautiful Bill, but I would guess not an insubstantial amount.
Kristen, I want to go back to you here. This is a fiscal policy bill, but a lot of people attribute Trump's victory last year to a kind of a vibe shift that actually didn't have to do with fiscal policy. It was as much about the culture war as the economy. And I understand that you recently worked on a project that shed some light on Republican attitudes about what used to be a major front in the culture war, gay marriage. So what did you find?
Yeah, so you're right. There is I don't want to put words in Ross Douthat's mouth, but I think he called it a vibe shift after the 2024 election that felt like a lot of the movement to the left socially and culturally, like that tide was coming back in a bit. And you've definitely seen that in terms of, I think, elite discourse around things like transgender issues. You've definitely seen some of that around discourse on like what are kids taught in schools and some of that kind of thorny stuff. But along with that, you've seen a variety of different state legislators putting forward bills to try to say, hey, look, if the winds have shifted in our direction, let's also try to capitalize on this moment and see if we can repeal same-sex marriage in some way, shape, or form. It's the 10th anniversary of the Supreme Court declaring that same-sex marriage would be legal across the country. And my research with a number of Republican pollsters, including some who have worked for the Trump campaign, we all basically found that for Republican voters, this is not the thing that fires them up. Even if they are, it's true that the winds have shifted politically. Republican voters are kind of over the idea that this is a battle we should fight. And especially when you tell them that Donald Trump, right after his election in 2016, said, like, I think this is a settled matter. That is a very persuasive piece of information for Republicans to learn at kind of turning down the temperature, making them go like, okay, this isn't a battle that that we want to fight. So while I think it's true that there was a sense of cultural excess on the part of the left and that we're now seeing the backlash to it, this is one issue where I think the backlash has not been as intense. And what I argue in the piece is that it is because Republicans still do have a little bit of libertarianism left in them. The death of libertarianism on the right is not complete. That this notion of, hey, if somebody else is doing something and it's not hurting me, they should be able to keep doing it, is still alive and well, and is part of why I think Republicans separate out something like gay marriage from some of these other battles on which they are pretty fired up.
So we're all old enough to remember when this was not the case in the Republican Party. In 2004, in particular, gay marriage was a huge issue. Karl Rove ran a turnout strategy for George W. Bush's second term, right, that was heavily based on turning out evangelical voters who opposed gay marriage. And this was a big issue. There was a lot of opposition, and that is just radically shifted in the last 20 years. And so Kristen says this is because Republican voters retain some sort of libertarianism. Matt Welch, do you buy that? Do you think there are, do you see a kind of nascent libertarian spark still somewhere in the embers of the Republican Party fire?
I mean, I prefer to just to think of it in terms of offense versus defense, not just for Republicans, but Americans. The gay marriage question, particularly after we started to see gay marriages, and Gavin Newsom deserves some credit from them way back when he was the mayor of San Francisco, right? They had the first sweet old grandmothers getting married on the courthouse steps back there. Once people had proximity to gay marriage happening, the sort of taboo was broken. The fear factor was broken. So we see the same thing with legalizing marijuana, although that's just starting to shift a little bit towards the tail end of it. But like familiarity with the thing, and also realizing that what you were doing in the previous regime of prohibiting this is that you were using the government to go on offense against people who just wanted to get married, right? So Americans have a natural sympathy for playing defense. If the government is coming after you, we want to help the people. But it's when those questions, when the side of people who want there to be legal gay marriage then go on offense and say, well, now you must bake the cake for the gay wedding or something. This is when that sense of solidarity shifts. And I think that's why the energy that used to be thrown into the gay marriage debate on the right is now much more about trans issues and surgery for minors and things that were adjudicated at the Supreme Court, at least the ability for states to do this in Tennessee. So where they think that the culture war has gone on offense and told people how to live their lives, people have a natural reaction against that. Republicans do, Americans do. I think it's a pretty normal reaction. So I don't overrate the amount of libertarianism in the body politic generally, in the Republican Party, Democratic Party. I am okay with it being a minority out there in the world, and you just argue where you can. But I think one line to make those arguments is precisely that. Is the government going on offense against individuals who are trying to live peaceably? And if so, I think you're going to be able to find a lot of Americans having sympathy with the victims of that.
Catherine, do you think the Republican Party is in some ways a little more libertarian under Donald Trump, who, you know, has attracted a kind of what has been called a barstool conservative that is at least more libertine in some ways, sort of more amenable to a kind of lifestyle libertarianism? Or do you think that this is just one specific issue and that, in fact, gay marriage hasn't become kind of a conservative, that the way the gay marriage debate has played out is that gay marriage has become at least a little bit conservative, just like it, in the way that people treat it, because it's marriage, because it's about family. That was Jonathan Rauch's argument when he wrote about the success of gay marriage for Reason a few years ago.
Yeah, my focus group of my kids, who are tweens and young teens, suggests that gay marriage feels different than some of the other issues that we just talked about. So, you know, we talk about politics a little in our house, and like they understand that abortion is controversial. They understand that trans issues, especially around young people, are controversial. They are just shocked down to the tips of their toes every time they hear information that reminds them that gay marriage wasn't legal even in their lifetimes in some places in the United States. They just are like, what are you talking about? That's bonkers. And I think whatever is causing that is the thing that we're talking about here, whether it's kind of the conservatism of the institution, whether it's the way that it's been woven into the fabric of American life. Obviously, they have lots of people in their lives who they know who are you know, families that either directly benefited from the same-sex marriage ruling by the court or from state rulings earlier. And so I think that there's something there. There's something there with the just like embeddedness of that fact into American life that feels different than a lot of the other social conservative rollback initiatives.
Matt Welch, one final question on a different topic before we move on to our cultural consumptions. As we all know, 2 weekends ago, Trump made the decision to bomb Iran. We were all against that on the podcast, at least partly because the possibility of escalation and a wider war, but at least for now, seems to have helped put a halt to the conflict between Israel and Iran. They stopped fighting. Did we get it wrong?
Maybe. Always. Maybe. Fallible.
Yeah, maybe.
But also, I think it's important to point out that there were moments in just about every single American military intervention in the Middle East over the past 35 years in which there was a similar like, oh, we might have got this one wrong. The anti-interventionists were not correct. I would point to three. And I'm not talking about mission accomplished posters either, people. I would point to in August of 2011, there was a lot of triumphalism about the Obama administration having made the decision to intervene in Libya, which they did, I believe, in March of that year. And by August, Gaddafi, an evil, horrible dictator who'd killed Americans, was out. And so you had an entire universe of Anne Marie Slaughters and other type of people saying, ha, 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 you pacifist, you were wrong. Hillary Clinton, who, of course, described this as smart power at its best, and various points in the prosecution of the war said, whose side are you on? Like Gaddafi's or ours, which is a messaging right now that Donald Trump is using against Thomas Massey. So there was that moment, but there was also December of 2001. We routed the government in Afghanistan, the Taliban, was dislodged, and Christopher Hitchens was writing pieces called Ha 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 and Yeah Boo to the pacifists. And it's right. You can use
one of the great prose stylists.
You can. You can point to that moment, and they were pretty quick to dislodge. Using American might can have effects. But what happens is that 20 years later, it was the most unpopular war in American history because we stayed and tried to do nation building and couldn't work out the details of what came after. Libya, let's remember, created one of the largest refugee crises, which had shockwaves throughout Europe and changed geopolitics. Wasn't always super great. Led to the creation of ISIL, long may it wave, as a direct side effect. Though what comes after is important. And the last example I'll use of that is the Gulf War of 1991. There was a sense of like, wow, we've gotten rid of Vietnam syndrome here. We won this victory so fast. It was crazy. But then what came after was like, well, maybe we need to police the skies. Maybe we need to protect this minority group from getting slaughtered by Saddam Hussein. Maybe we need to back up our weapons non-proliferation with a force of American arms. So sort of a low-level anti-sovereignty kind of policing action. And that softened the ground, whetted the appetite, all the other metaphors that I'll mix for Catherine's sake, like maybe we should do more. How are we, you know, we control the skies. Why aren't we deposing the dictator? I predict that that is an exact conversation that's going to be happening because Israel controls the skies over Iran right now. Why aren't we deposing one of the most evil dictators who has killed Americans? There's going to be a lot of effects that we haven't worked through so far. And I don't really see what those pathways are going to be. And I just predict it's going to be complicated. And so this is the high watermark right now of saying, hey, maybe this worked. But we've seen in the past that doesn't always work out that way in the end.
In short, defund the sky police, maybe? I don't know. All right, let's move on to our final segment. This is our cultural recommendations. We're going to start with Kristen, because I think you and I saw the same movie this weekend. F1, I really liked it, but I am not a racing fan, and I know that you are. What did you think?
I loved it. I am a massive motorsports fan. My fandom predates getting hooked on Drive to Survive, but like many, Drive to Survive is the thing that really inflamed my love of motorsports and specifically Formula One in the last couple of years. And this movie is ridiculous in all the right ways. I had the good fortune of watching Cars 3 with my toddler in the week leading up to this. And it's kind of just a live action Cars 3, like with the same level of attachment to reality. Cars 3 is a movie about like Lightning McQueen. He's old. He's at the end of his career. And like, does he decide to mentor a new driver? I mean, it's like the perfect pairing. But this movie is gorgeous. And I'm curious, for someone who does not follow F1, I'm glad that it seems to be getting a pretty good reception for the insane visuals, but there's also so much there if you are a really, really, really deep F1 fan. Like an example is, there's a shot where Brad Pitt is running up a hill. He is leading a pack of his fellow F1 teammates on like a jog around a track. And if you know nothing about racing, you're just like, oh, they're running up a beautiful hill in Belgium. And if you do follow F1, you are like, they are running up one of the most iconic curves in global motorsport. It's called Eau Rouge. It's part of the Spa circuit in Belgium. It's incredible. You're like, Brad Pitt is running up Eau Rouge. This is insane. So there's something for the casual fan who has no idea of the significance of these things and just thinks, this is beautiful. This looks cool. This is awesome. But if you are a super fan, the number of little details that they got right that are just pure fan service to super F1 fans is amazing. You have to set aside that some of the on-track action is patently ridiculous and things occur that would never occur in a real F1 race. But if you're able to turn that part of your brain off for 2 hours, it's fantastic.
So I did not recognize that specific curve, but I know exactly the shot you were talking about because I noticed that's a really interesting looking curve, the bank of it, the specific super high bank, right? And you're able to kind of see the layout of the course and the like what drivers are facing in a way that's really sort of, it's really evocative and it lets you sort of see it in slow motion, which is the point of running the track, right? Sort of to get a sense of it, like walking a city rather than taking an Uber around, right? You just get a real sense of sort of what it's like on the ground in a different way.
Really happens too.
Yeah.
That's like, it's one of the little details that like, if you follow F1, the drivers all walk the track in the like days leading up to a race. So it's not just added for visual effect. It's a real thing.
I assumed that that was real, but I didn't know. And I liked seeing all of those details, which were presented at just the right level, I think, for someone like me who, like I said, I'm a movie fan, but not a racing fan. And I was thinking about this in the contrast to a racing movie that came out just a couple of years ago, Gran Turismo, which is about the basically PlayStation teamed up with GT Racing to bring a driver who had learned to race entirely through their very accurate video game. You're not even supposed to call it a video game. You're supposed to call it a racing simulator. That's how fussy they are about this sort of thing. And it's an okay movie at times, but it's not a great movie. And one of the big problems with that movie is you just don't get any real sense of the technical challenges of the sport, because this is an incredibly technical sport where the drivers and the team are doing a huge amount of kind of planning and thinking both about the strategy of how they're going to move the cars around the track, but also about how they're going to design their cars and how those cars operate. And F1 gives you an awful lot more of that. It gives you a lot of the rules of the races that Brad Pitt is constantly breaking and abusing to his own ends in ways that even I
for life by yes. like the first 20 minutes of racing right. this film.
Even I could tell that's absurd. On the other hand, I appreciated it, and I appreciated it in a specific way, which was this was, yes, a good movie about racing, and yes, a really great technical accomplishment, just in the way that Joseph Kosinski, who previously gave us Top Gun Maverick, which had Tom Cruise, you know, in an actual fighter jet and like just looked amazing because all of those shots were Tom Cruise in a fighter jet. And here you see Brad Pitt in an actual F1 car, and all of these shots are actually taken on, you know, real courses. So it's great as a technical achievement, but it is also a perfect throwback to the 90s action movies that have become kind of dad action movie classics, in particular the run of things produced starting in the 80s with like Days of Thunder, the original Top Gun, The Rock, Crimson Tide even. All of these are movies produced by Jerry Bruckheimer and, before he died, Don Simpson. And you really just see the DNA of all of those great old kind of fun, often Nick Cage starring or sort of some, like there's a big star. He's kind of a macho guy where he throws his weight around,
Armageddon.
Like gets himself in a little bit. Right. Armageddon. Yes. All of these are the movies I think several of us on this podcast grew up on. And even the bad ones are like, you look back on them and they're like, actually, that was pretty enjoyable. It really, like, Con Air is not a great movie, but it's a really great movie. And this F1, in the same way, is not exactly a great movie in the good movie, like a cinema sense, but it's an incredibly satisfying, entertaining summer movie that also does a lot of racing stuff, right? So glad we were all able to see that and recommend it to anybody who likes racing or 90s action movies. Catherine, what did you watch or read or experience this week?
I did go to a movie theater and also see, I suppose, what you might call a live action reboot of an animated classic such as Cars 3, but it was How to Train Your Dragon, and I'm not going to say any more about it. Instead, what I'm going to talk about is the highlight of my week last week, which was the two recent events I attended. The Reason versus Debate here in Washington, D.C., which Suderman moderated and which featured reasoners Billy Binion and Jacob Sullum defending the honor of drugs. It was legalize all drugs. It was a delightful, spicy little debate. And the highlight was definitely Charles Fain Lehman, one of the Manhattan Institute debaters that the reasoners were up against, saying, ah, yes, fentanyl lollipops for everyone. I really enjoyed that moment. As well as many others. And then I hopped on a train and went to New York and went to the Speakeasy featuring Nick Gillespie and Elizabeth Nolan Brown talking about the MAHA movement. I ate a Twinkie while I was there because the food spread was half like fresh fruit and half processed food, which was delightful. And the two of them crammed more words into 1 hour than I think is maybe possible in any other Reason product. So I urge you to go check out the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie when that one airs. It is
both of those events were about what you can do with your body, just kind of fundamentally, like, can you put drugs in it? How are you going to eat? Like, is red dye number 3 going to kill all of us? Like, just great, solid Reason events that, like, get to the core of what we're about, which is bodily autonomy and personal freedom. Matt Welch, what libertarian-leaning, relevant thing did you consume in the past week?
So, you know, Benjamin Franklin wanted the autonomy to put in his body as much port as humanly possible.
Yes.
I watched a Apple TV series from last year called Franklin, starring Michael Douglas as the old coot, when he was in Paris negotiating for the United States to have an alliance with France in the Revolutionary War. So it just bites that chunk off. It's a long chunk. It's 8 years. I have watched 6 of the 8 episodes, and apparently I'm in the minority who thinks this is super great. It doesn't have gigantic Metacritic ratings, and reviews were kind of tepid. There are reasons why it hits me in the sweet spot. Obviously, I've been binging a lot on Revolutionary War era, founding era stuff for quite a while now. So that's exciting. I'm doing that with my 10-year-old daughter, who also loves this. Also, as mentioned before, just like instead of like we're going to do the entire sweep of this famous founder's crazy career, which is what they did with the John Adams miniseries, which I abandoned at some point because of the camera angles, like enough. And also because Paul Giamatti is just kind of grotesque to watch after a while. This is just like, no, he had a problem to solve. How did he do it? And it got to the sort of the boredom, the NUI of like, am I really doing this well? Am I not doing it well? I love that in fiction because it's almost never portrayed God, this is, I'm wasting time here. There's something that you saw in the HBO miniseries Generation Kill, for example, that I thought was really great. Michael Douglas does something that, like, solves a riddle that I guess I've always sort of had. It's like, Benjamin Franklin, when you look at him, he's kind of this gross old guy, but he was always portrayed as like almost impossibly charming, especially in his tenure in Paris, where, you know, he starts when he's 70 years old. He has gout in his feet and it's gross. And he's up there like chatting with ladies and doing charming stuff. Having a movie star, a bona fide movie star who's also old, come out and do it is just terrific. His performance is fantastic. But also another reason why this I like this in particular, and it's my sweet spot, is because my kids are bilingual French, and half of this thing is in French with great French actors. And the what they do with the French language is super interesting, including the ways that the Benjamin Franklin character speaks it, the John Adams character just hacks through it, the son, other things. It's really, really interesting in that way. It's a great co-production, rightly so. Just really have loved it. And I presume the last 2 episodes will be good as well. But check it out. Came out last year, Apple TV, Franklin, starring Michael Douglas and a bunch of pretty good Frenchmen and Quebecois and stuff, including the Marquis de Lafayette. Really enjoyed it.
We cannot let that analysis pass without dealing with the way that you just pronounced the word ennui.
I hope that this show has cured your ennui, not your NUI, which is, it's not an acronym. It's a French word, and you're supposed to be.
I was going
to
let it go until you were like,
your kids are
not
French bilingual. It's ennui.
Ennui.
What are the chances?
Ennui. Ennui.
It's ennui. Well, how did I pronounce ennui?
NUI. You said NUI.
Did I? Oh, well.
Ennui. Is that the thing that can be fixed in post?
Never.
We're going to let it. This is going in the final.
Okay.
All right. Before we go, the Reason Roundtable will be coming at you live in New York City. There will be no NUI there. We're going to be at the Village Underground on July 15th. That's Tuesday, July 15th. Join us as we talk about the news and answer many of your questions. It's going to be a hot one and a fun one. As always, if you like this podcast, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you all so much for listening. The Reason Roundtable will return.